last week," she said. "I've been married to Othello, been loved by Faust, and been kidnapped by Paris. Wouldn't you say I was the luckiest girl in town?"
I said I thought so, and I told her most of the women in town thought so, too.
"They had their chance," she said.
"Most of them couldn't stand the excitement," I said. And I told her I'd been asked to direct another play. I asked if she and Harry would be available for the cast. She gave me a big smile and said,
"Who are we this time?"
Welcome to the Monkey House, read by David Strathairn. So Pete Crocker, the sheriff of Barnstable County, which was the whole of Cape Cod, came into the Federal Ethical Suicide Parlor in Hyannis one May afternoon, and he told the 2 6-foot hostesses there that they weren't to be alarmed, but that a notorious nothinghead named Billy the Poet was believed headed for the Cape. A nothinghead was a person who refused to take his ethical birth control pills 3 times a day. The penalty for that was $10,000 and 10 years in jail. This was at a time when the population of Earth was 17 billion human beings. That was far too many mammals that big for a planet that small. The people were virtually packed together like drupelets. Drupelets are the pulpy little knobs that compose the outside of a raspberry. So the world government was making a 2-pronged attack on overpopulation. One pronging was the encouragement of ethical suicide, which consisted of going to the nearest suicide parlor and asking a hostess to kill you painlessly while you lay on a barcolounger. The other pronging was compulsory ethical birth control. The sheriff told the hostesses, who were pretty, tough-minded, highly intelligent girls, that roadblocks were being set up and house-to-house searches were being conducted to catch Billy the Poet. The main difficulty was that the police didn't know what he looked like. The few people who had seen him, and known him for what he was, were women, and they disagreed fantastically as to his height, his hair color, his voice, his weight, the color of his skin. "I don't need to remind you girls," the sheriff went on, "that a nothinghead is very sensitive from the waist down. If Billy the Poet somehow slips in here and starts making trouble, one good kick in the right place will do wonders." He was referring to the fact that ethical birth control pills, the only legal form of birth control, made people numb from the waist down. Most men said their bottom halves felt like cold iron or balsa wood. Most women said their bottom halves felt like wet cotton or stale ginger ale. The pills were so effective that you could blindfold a man who had taken one, tell him to recite the Gettysburg Address, kick him in the balls while he was doing it, and he wouldn't miss a syllable. The pills were ethical because they didn't interfere with a person's ability to reproduce, which would have been unnatural and immoral. All the pills did was take every bit of pleasure out of sex. Thus did science and morals go hand in hand. The 2 hostesses there in Hyannis were Nancy McLuhan and Mary Kraft. Nancy was a strawberry blonde, Mary was a glossy brunette. Their uniforms were white lipstick, heavy eye makeup, purple body stockings with nothing underneath, and black leather boots. They ran a small operation with only 6 suicide booths. In a really good week, say the one before Christmas, they might put 60 people to sleep. It was done with a hypodermic syringe. "My main message to you girls," said Sheriff Crocker, "is that everything's well under control. You can just go about your business here."
"Didn't you leave out part of your main message?" Nancy asked him.
"I don't get you."
"I didn't hear you say he was probably headed straight for us."
He shrugged in clumsy innocence.
"We don't know that for sure."
"I thought that was all anybody did know about Billy the Poet. That he specializes in deflowering hostesses in ethical suicide parlors." Nancy was a virgin. All hostesses were virgins. They also had to hold advanced degrees in psychology and nursing. They also had to be plump and rosy and at least 6 feet tall. America had changed in many ways, but it had yet to adopt the metric system. Nancy McLuhan was burned up that the sheriff would try to protect her and Mary from the full truth about Billy the Poet, as though they might panic if they heard it. She told the sheriff so. "How long do you think a girl would last in the ESS," she said, meaning the Ethical Suicide Service, "if she's scared that easy?" The sheriff took a step backward, pulled in his chin. "Not very long, I guess." "That's very true," said Nancy, closing the distance between them and offering him a sniff of the edge of her hand, which was poised for a karate chop. All hostesses were experts at judo and karate. "If you'd like to find out how helpless we are, just come toward me, pretending you're Billy the Poet." The sheriff shook his head, gave her a glassy smile. "I'd rather not." "That's the smartest thing you've said today," said Nancy, turning her back on him while Mary laughed. "We're not scared. We're angry. Or we're even not that. He isn't worth that. We're bored. How boring that he should come a great distance, should cause all this fuss in order to..." She let the sentence die there. "It's just too absurd. I'm not as mad at him as I am at the women who let him do it to them without a struggle," said Mary. "Who let him do it and then couldn't tell the police what he looked like. Suicide hostesses at that." "Somebody hasn't been keeping up with her karate," said Nancy. It wasn't just Billy the Poet who was attracted to hostesses in ethical suicide parlors. All nothing heads were. Bombed out of their skulls with the sex madness that came from taking nothing, they thought the white lips and big eyes and body stocking and boots of a hostess spelled sex, sex, sex. The truth was, of course, that sex was the last thing any hostess ever had in mind. "If Billy follows his usual M.O.," said the sheriff, "he'll study your habits and the neighborhood. And then he'll pick one or the other of you, and he'll send her a dirty poem in the mail."
"Charming," said Nancy.
"He has also been known to use the telephone."
"How brave," said Nancy.
Over the sheriff's shoulder, she could see the mailman coming. A blue light went on over the door of a booth for which Nancy was responsible. The person in there wanted something. It was the only booth in use at the time. The sheriff asked her if there was a possibility that the person in there was Billy the Poet, and Nancy said, "Well, if it is, I can break his neck with my thumb and forefinger."
"Foxy Grandpa," said Mary, who'd seen him too. A foxy grandpa was any old man, cute and senile, who quibbled and joked and reminisced for hours before he let a hostess put him to sleep.
Nancy groaned. "We've spent the past 2 hours trying to decide on a last meal." And then the mailman came in with just one letter. It was addressed to Nancy in smeary pencil. She was splendid with anger and disgust as she opened it, knowing it would be a piece of filth from Billy. She was right. Inside the envelope was a poem. It wasn't an original poem. It was a song from olden days that had taken on new meanings since the numbness of ethical birth control had become universal. It went like this, in smeary pencil again. "We were walking through the park, a-goosing statues in the dark. If Sherman's horse can take it, so can you." When Nancy came into the suicide booth to see what he wanted, the foxy grandpa was lying on the mint-green barco lounger where hundreds had died so peacefully over the years. He was studying the menu from the Howard Johnson's next door and beating time to the muzak coming from the loudspeaker on the lemon-yellow wall. The room was painted cinderblock. There was one barred window with a Venetian blind. There was a Howard Johnson's next door to every ethical suicide parlor, and vice versa. The Howard Johnson's had an orange roof, and the suicide parlor had a purple roof, but they were both the government. Practically everything was the government. Practically everything was automated, too. Nancy and Mary and the sheriff were lucky to have jobs. Most people didn't. The average citizen moped around home and watched television, which was the government. Every 15 minutes, his television would urge him to vote intelligently or consume intelligently or worship in the church of his choice, or love his fellow men, or obey the laws, or pay a call to the nearest ethical suicide parlor and find out how friendly and understanding a hostess could be. The foxy grandpa was something of a rarity, since he was marked by old age, was bald, was shaky, had spots on his hands. Most people looked 22, thanks to the anti-aging shots they took twice a year. That the old man looked old was proof that the shots had been discovered after his sweet bird of youth had flown. "Have we decided on a last supper yet?" Nancy asked him. She heard peevishness in her own voice, heard herself betray her exasperation with Billy the Poet, her boredom with the old man. She was ashamed, for this was unprofessional of her. "The breaded veal cutlet is very good." The old man cocked his head. With the greedy cunning of second childhood, he had caught her being unprofessional, unkind, and he was going to punish her for it.
"You don't sound very friendly. I thought you were all supposed to be friendly. I thought this was supposed to be a pleasant place to come."
"I beg your pardon," she said. "If I seem unfriendly, it has nothing to do with you."
"I thought maybe I bored you."
"No, no," she said gamely, "not at all. You certainly know some very interesting history." Among other things, the foxy grandpa claimed to have known J. Edgar Nation, the Grand Rapids druggist who was the father of ethical birth control.
"Then look like you're interested," he told her.
He could get away with that sort of impudence. The thing was, he could leave any time he wanted to, right up to the moment he asked for the needle. And he had to ask for the needle. That was the law. Nancy's art, and the art of every hostess, was to see that volunteers didn't leave, to coax and wheedle and flatter them patiently every step of the way. So Nancy had to sit down there in the booth to pretend to marvel at the freshness of the yarn the old man told, a story everybody knew, about how J. Edgar Nation happened to experiment with ethical birth control.
"He didn't have the slightest idea his pills would be taken by human beings someday," said the foxy grandpa. "His dream was to introduce morality into the monkey house at the Grand Rapids Zoo. Did you realize that?"
he inquired severely.
"No, no, I didn't. That's very interesting. He and his 11 kids went to church one Easter, and the day was so nice, and the Easter service had been so beautiful and pure, that they decided to take a walk through the zoo, and they were just walking on clouds."
"Oh." The scene described was lifted from a play that was performed on television every Easter. The foxy grandpa shoehorned himself into the scene, had himself chat with the Nations just before they got to the monkey house.
"Good morning, Mr. Nation," I said to him. "It certainly is a nice morning." "And a good morning to you, Mr. Howard," he said to me. "There is nothing like an Easter morning to make a man feel clean and reborn and at one with God's intentions."
"Hmm." Nancy could hear the telephone ringing faintly, naggingly through the nearly soundproof door.
"So, we went on to the monkey house together, and what do you think we saw?"
"I can't imagine." Somebody had answered the phone.
"We saw a monkey playing with his private parts."
"No."
"Yes. And J. Edgar Nation was so upset, he went straight home and he started developing a pill that would make monkeys in the springtime fit things for a Christian family to see."
There was a knock on the door. "Yes," said Nancy. "Nancy," said Mary, "telephone for you." When Nancy came out of the booth, she found the sheriff choking on little squeals of law enforcement delight. The telephone was tapped by agents hidden in the Howard Johnsons. Billy the Poet was believed to be on the line. His call had been traced. Police were already on their way to grab him.
"Keep him on. Keep him on,"
the sheriff whispered to Nancy, and he gave her the telephone as though it were solid gold.
"Yes," said Nancy.
"Nancy McLuhan,"
said a man. His voice was disguised. He might have been speaking through a kazoo.
I'm calling for a mutual friend.
Oh?
He asked me to deliver a message.
I see.
It's a poem.
All right.
Ready?
Ready. Nancy could hear sirens screaming in the background of the call. The caller must have heard the sirens, too, but he recited the poem without any emotion. It went like this.
Soak yourself in Jergens lotion. Here comes the one-man population explosion.
They got him. Nancy heard it all. The thumping and clumping, the argle-bargle and cries. The depression she felt as she hung up was glandular. Her brave body had prepared for a fight that was not to be. The sheriff bounded out of the suicide parlor in such a hurry to see the famous criminal he'd helped catch that a sheaf of papers fell from the pocket of his trench coat. Mary picked them up, called after the sheriff. He halted for a moment, said the papers didn't matter anymore, asked her if maybe she wouldn't like to come along. There was a flurry between the two girls, with Nancy persuading Mary to go, declaring that she had no curiosity about Billy. So Mary left, irrelevantly handing the sheaf to Nancy. The sheaf proved to be photocopies of poems Billy had sent to hostesses in other places. Nancy read the top one. It made much of a peculiar side effect of ethical birth control pills. They not only made people numb, they also made people piss blue. The poem was called What the Something Head Said to the Suicide Hostess, and it went like this. I did not sew, I did not spin, and thanks to pills I did not sin. I loved the crowds, the stink, the noise, and when I peed turquoise. I ate beneath a roof of orange, swung with progress like a door hinge. Neath purple roof I've come today to piss my azure life away. Virgin hostess, death's recruiter, life is cute, but you are cuter. Mourn my pecker, purple daughter. All it passed was sky-blue water. You never heard that story before. About how J. Edgar Nation came to invent ethical birth control? The foxy grandpa wanted to know. His voice cracked. Never did, lied Nancy.
I thought everybody knew that.
It was news to me.
When he got through with the monkey house, you couldn't tell it from the Michigan Supreme Court. Meanwhile, there was this crisis going on in the United Nations. The people who understood science said people had to quit reproducing so much, and the people who understood morals said society would collapse if people used sex for nothing but pleasure.
The foxy grandpa got off his barco lounger, went over to the window, pried two slats of the blind apart. There wasn't much to see out there. The view was blocked by the backside of a mocked-up thermometer, 20 feet high, which faced the street. It was calibrated in billions of people on Earth from 0 to 20. The make-believe column of liquid was a strip of translucent red plastic. It showed how many people there were on Earth. Very close to the bottom was a black arrow that showed what the scientists thought the population ought to be. The foxy grandpa was looking at the setting sun through that red plastic, and through the blind, too, so that his face was banded with shadows and red.
"Tell me," he said, "when I die, how much will that thermometer go down? A foot?"
"No."
"An inch?"
"Not quite." "You know what the answer is, don't you?" he said, and he faced her. The senility had vanished from his voice and eyes. 1 inch on that thing equals 83,333 people. You knew that, didn't you?"
That might be true," said Nancy, "but that isn't the right way to look at it, in my opinion."
He didn't ask her what the right way was, in her opinion. He completed a thought of his own instead.
"I'll tell you something else that's true. I'm Billy the Poet, and you're a very good-looking woman."
With one hand, he drew a snub-nosed revolver from his belt. With the other, he peeled off his bald dome and wrinkled forehead, which proved to be rubber. Now he looked 22.
The police will want to know exactly what I look like when this is all over, he told Nancy with a malicious grin. In case you're not good at describing people, and it's surprising how many women aren't, I'm 5'2", with eyes of blue, with brown hair to my shoulders, a manly elf, so full of self. The ladies say he smolders. Billy was 10 inches shorter than Nancy was. She had about 40 pounds on him. She told him he didn't have a chance, but Nancy was much mistaken. He had unbolted the bars on the window the night before, and he made her go out the window and then down a manhole that was hidden from the street by the big thermometer. He took her down into the sewers of Hyannis. He knew where he was going. He had a flashlight and a map. Nancy had to go before him along the narrow catwalk, her own shadow dancing mockingly in the lead. She tried to guess where they were, relative to the real world above. She guessed correctly when they passed under the Howard Johnsons, guessed from noises she heard. The machinery that processed and served the food there was silent. But, so people wouldn't feel too lonesome when eating there, the designers had provided sound effects for the kitchen. It was these Nancy heard, a tape recording of the clashing of silverware and the laughter of Negroes and Puerto Ricans. After that, she was lost. Billy had very little to say to her, other than right or left or don't try anything funny, Juno, or I'll blow your great big fucking head off. Only once did they have anything resembling a conversation. Billy began it and ended it, too. What in hell is a girl with hips like yours doing selling death? He asked her from behind. She dared to stop. I can answer that, she told him. She was confident that she could give him an answer that would shrivel him like napalm. But he gave her a shove, offered to blow her fucking head off again. You don't even want to hear my answer, she taunted him. You're afraid to hear it. I never listen to a woman till the pills wear off, sneered Billy. That was his plan, then, to keep her a prisoner for at least 8 hours. That was how long it took for the pills to wear off. That's a silly rule. A woman's not a woman till the pills wear off. You certainly managed to make a woman feel like an object rather than a person. Thank the pills for that, said Billy. There were 80 miles of sewers under Greater Hyannis, which had a population of 400,000 druplets, 400,000 souls. Nancy lost track of the time down there. When Billy announced that they had at last reached their destination, it was possible for Nancy to imagine that a year had passed. She tested this spooky impression by pinching her own thigh, by feeling what the chemical clock of her body said. Her thigh was still numb. Billy ordered her to climb iron rungs that were set in wet masonry. There was a circle of sickly light above. It proved to be moonlight filtered through the plastic polygons of an enormous geodesic dome. Nancy didn't have to ask the traditional victim's question, "Where am I?" There was only one dome like that on Cape Cod. It was in Hyannisport, and it sheltered the ancient Kennedy compound. It was a museum of how life had been lived in more expansive times. The museum was closed. It was open only in the summertime. The manhole from which Nancy and then Billy emerged was set in an expanse of green cement, which showed where the Kennedy lawn had been. On the green cement, in front of the ancient frame houses, were statues representing the 14 Kennedys who had been presidents of the United States or the world. They were playing touch football. The president of the world at the time of Nancy's abduction, incidentally, was an ex-suicide hostess named Ma Kennedy. Her statue would never join this particular touch football game. Her name was Kennedy, all right, but she wasn't the real thing. People complained of her lack of style, found her vulgar. On the wall of her office was a sign that said, "You don't have to be crazy to work here, but it sure helps." And another one that said, "Thimpk." And another one that said, "Someday, we're going to have to get organized around here." Her office was in the Taj Mahal.
Until she arrived in the Kennedy Museum, Nancy McLuhan was confident that she would sooner or later get a chance to break every bone in Billy's little body, maybe even shoot him with his own gun. She wouldn't have minded doing those things. She thought he was more disgusting than a blood-filled tick. It wasn't compassion that changed her mind. It was the discovery that Billy had a gang. There were at least 8 people around the manhole, men and women in equal numbers, with stockings pulled over their heads. It was the women who laid firm hands on Nancy, told her to keep calm. They were all at least as tall as Nancy, and they held her in places where they could hurt her like hell if they had to. Nancy closed her eyes, but this didn't protect her from the obvious conclusion. These perverted women were sisters from the Ethical Suicide Service. This upset her so much that she asked loudly and bitterly, "How can you violate your oaths like this?" She was promptly hurt so badly that she doubled up and burst into tears. When she straightened up again, there was plenty more she wanted to say, but she kept her mouth shut. She speculated silently as to what on earth could make suicide hostesses turn against every concept of human decency. Nothing-headedness alone couldn't begin to explain it. They had to be drugged besides. Nancy went over in her mind all the terrible drugs she'd learned about in school, persuaded herself that the women had taken the worst one of all. That drug was so powerful, Nancy's teachers had told her, that even a person numb from the waist down would copulate repeatedly and enthusiastically after just one glass. That had to be the answer. The women, and probably the men too, had been drinking gin. They hastened Nancy into the middle frame house, which was dark like all the rest, and Nancy heard the men giving Billy the news. It was in this news that Nancy perceived a glint of hope. Help might be on its way. The gang member who had phoned Nancy obscenely had fooled the police into believing that they had captured Billy the Poet, which was bad for Nancy. The police didn't know yet that Nancy was missing, 2 men told Billy. And a telegram had been sent to Mary Craft in Nancy's name, declaring that Nancy had been called to New York City on urgent family business. That was where Nancy saw the glint of hope. Mary wouldn't believe that telegram. Mary knew Nancy had no family in New York. Not one of the 63 million people living there was a relative of Nancy's. The gang had deactivated the burglar alarm system of the museum. They had also cut through a lot of the chains and ropes that were meant to keep visitors from touching anything of value. There was no mystery as to who and what had done the cutting. One of the men was armed with brutal lopping shears. They marched Nancy into a servant's bedroom upstairs. The man with the shears cut the ropes that fenced off the narrow bed. They put Nancy into the bed, and 2 men held Nancy, while a woman gave her a knockout shot. Billy the Poet had disappeared. As Nancy was going under, the woman who had given her the shot asked her how old she was. Nancy was determined not to answer, but discovered that the drug had made her powerless not to answer. 63, she murmured. How does it feel to be a virgin at 63? Nancy heard her own answer through a velvet fog. She was amazed by the answer, wanted to protest that it couldn't possibly be hers. Pointless, she'd said. Moments later, she asked the woman thickly, What was in that needle? What was in the needle, Honeybunch? Why, Honeybunch, they call that truth serum. The moon was down when Nancy woke up, but the night was still out there. The shades were drawn, and there was candlelight. Nancy had never seen a lit candle before. What awakened Nancy was a dream of mosquitoes and bees. Mosquitoes and bees were extinct, so were birds. But Nancy dreamed that millions of insects were swarming about her from the waist down. They didn't sting. They fanned her. Nancy was a nothinghead. She went to sleep again. When she awoke next time, she was being led into a bathroom by 3 women, still with stockings over their heads. The bathroom was already filled with the steam from somebody else's bath. There were somebody else's wet footprints crisscrossing the floor, and the air reeked of pine needle perfume. Her will and intelligence returned as she was bathed and perfumed and dressed in a white nightgown. When the women stepped back to admire her, she said to them quietly, "I may be a nothinghead now, but that doesn't mean I have to think like one or act like one." Nobody argued with her. Nancy was taken downstairs and out of the house. She fully expected to be sent down a manhole again. It would be the perfect setting for her violation by Billy, she was thinking. Down in a sewer. But they took her across the green cement, where the grass used to be, and then across the yellow cement, where the beach used to be, and then out onto the blue cement, where the harbor used to be. There were 26 yachts that had belonged to various Kennedys, sunk up to their water lines in blue cement. It was to the most ancient of these yachts, the Marlin, once the property of Joseph P. Kennedy, that they delivered Nancy. It was dawn. Because of the high-rise apartments all around the Kennedy Museum, it would be an hour before any direct sunlight would reach the microcosm under the geodesic dome. Nancy was escorted as far as the companionway to the forward cabin of the Marlin. The women pantomimed that she was expected to go down the five steps alone. Nancy froze for the moment, and so did the women. There were two actual statues in the tableau on the bridge. Standing at the wheel was a statue of Frank Wirtanen, once skipper of the Marlin. And next to him was his son and first mate, Carly. They weren't paying any attention to poor Nancy. They were staring out through the windshield at the blue cement. Nancy, barefoot and wearing a thin white nightgown, descended bravely into the forward cabin, which was a pool of candlelight and pine needle perfume. The companionway hatch was closed and locked behind her. Nancy's emotions and the antique furnishings of the cabin were so complex that Nancy could not at first separate Billy the Poet from his surroundings, from all the mahogany and leaded glass. And then she saw him, at the far end of the cabin, with his back against the door to the forward cockpit. He was wearing purple silk pajamas with a Russian collar. They were piped in red, and writhing across Billy's silken breast was a golden dragon. It was belching fire. Anticlimactically, Billy was wearing glasses. He was holding a book. Nancy poised herself on the next to the bottom step, took a firm grip on the handholds in the companionway. She bared her teeth, calculated that it would take 10 men Billy's size to dislodge her. Between them was a great table. Nancy had expected the cabin to be dominated by a bed, possibly in the shape of a swan. But the Marlin was a dayboat. The cabin was anything but a seraglio. It was about as voluptuous as a lower middle-class dining room in Akron, Ohio, around 1910. A candle was on the table. So were an ice bucket and two glasses and a quart of champagne. Champagne was as illegal as heroin. Billy took off his glasses, gave her a shy, embarrassed smile, said, "Welcome. This is as far as I come." He accepted that. "You're very beautiful there." "And what am I supposed to say? That you're stunningly handsome? That I feel an overwhelming desire to throw myself into your manly arms?" "If you wanted to make me happy, that would certainly be the way to do it." He said that humbly. "And what about my happiness?" The question seemed to puzzle him. "Nancy, that's what this is all about. What if my idea of happiness doesn't coincide with yours? And what do you think my idea of happiness is?" "I'm not going to throw myself into your arms, and I'm not going to drink that poison, and I'm not going to budge from here unless somebody makes me," said Nancy. "So I think your idea of happiness is going to turn out to be 8 people holding me down on that table while you bravely hold that cocked pistol to my head and do what you want. That's the way it's going to have to be, so call your friends and get it over with." Which he did. He didn't hurt her. He deflowered her with a clinical skill she found ghastly. When it was all over, he didn't seem cocky or proud. On the contrary, he was terribly depressed, and he said to Nancy, "Believe me, if there'd been any other way." Her reply to this was a face like stone, and silent tears of humiliation. His helpers let down a folding bunk from the wall. It was scarcely wider than a bookshelf and hung on chains. Nancy allowed herself to be put to bed in it, and she was left alone with Billy the Poet again. Big as she was, like a double bass wedged onto that narrow shelf, she felt like a pitiful little thing. A scratchy, war surplus blanket had been tucked in around her. It was her own idea to pull up a corner of the blanket to hide her face. Nancy sensed from sounds what Billy was doing, which wasn't much. He was sitting at the table, sighing occasionally, sniffing occasionally, turning the pages of a book. He lit a cigar, and the stink of it seeped under her blanket. Billy inhaled the cigar, then coughed and coughed and coughed. When the coughing died down, Nancy said loathingly through the blanket, "You're so strong, so masterful, so healthy. It must be wonderful to be so manly." Billy only sighed at this. "I'm not a very typical nothinghead," she said. "I hated it, hated everything about it." Billy sniffed, turned a page. "I suppose all the other women just loved it, couldn't get enough of it." "Nope." She uncovered her face. "What do you mean, nope?" "They've all been like you." This was enough to make Nancy sit up and stare at him. "The women who helped you tonight? What about them? You've done to them what you did to me?" He didn't look up from his book. "That's right." "Then why don't they kill you instead of helping you?" "Because they understand." And then he added mildly, "They're grateful." Nancy got out of bed, came to the table, gripped the edge of the table, leaned close to him, and she said to him tautly, "I am not grateful." "You will be. And what could possibly bring about that miracle?" "Time," said Billy. Billy closed his book, stood up. Nancy was confused by his magnetism. Somehow he was very much in charge again. "What you've been through, Nancy," he said, "is a typical wedding night for a straight-laced girl of 100 years ago, when everybody was a nothinghead. The groom did without helpers, because the bride wasn't customarily ready to kill him. Otherwise, the spirit of the occasion was much the same. These are the pajamas my great-great-grandfather wore on his wedding night in Niagara Falls. According to his diary, his bride cried all that night and threw up twice. But with the passage of time, she became a sexual enthusiast." It was Nancy's turn to reply by not replying. She understood the tale. It frightened her to understand so easily that, from gruesome beginnings, sexual enthusiasm could grow and grow. "You're a very typical nothinghead," said Billy. "If you dare to think about it now, you'll realize that you're angry because I'm such a bad lover, and a funny-looking shrimp besides. And what you can't help dreaming about from now on is a really suitable mate for a Juno like yourself. You'll find him, too, tall and strong and gentle. The nothinghead movement is growing by leaps and bounds." "But," said Nancy, and she stopped there. She looked out a porthole at the rising sun.
"But what?"
"The world is in the mess it is today because of the nothing-headedness of olden times. Don't you see?" She was pleading weakly. "The world can't afford sex anymore."
"Of course it can afford sex," said Billy.
"All it can't afford anymore is reproduction."
Then why the laws? They're bad laws, said Billy. If you go back through history, you'll find that the people who have been most eager to rule, to make the laws, to enforce the laws, and to tell everybody exactly how God Almighty wants things here on earth, those people have forgiven themselves and their friends for anything and everything, but they have been absolutely disgusted and terrified by the natural sexuality of common men and women. Why this is, I do not know. That is one of the many questions I wish somebody would ask the machines. I do know this. The triumph of that sort of disgust and terror is now complete. Almost every man and woman looks and feels like something the cat dragged in. The only sexual beauty that an ordinary human being can see today is in the woman who will kill him. Sex is death. There's a short and nasty equation for you. Sex is death, QED. So you see, Nancy, said Billy, I have spent this night, and many others like it, attempting to restore a certain amount of innocent pleasure to the world, which is poorer in pleasure than it needs to be. Nancy sat down quietly and bowed her head. I'll tell you what my grandfather did on the dawn of his wedding night, said Billy. I don't think I want to hear it. It isn't violent. It's meant to be tender. Maybe that's why I don't want to hear it. He read his bride a poem. Billy took the book from the table, opened it. His diary tells which poem it was. While we aren't bride and groom, and while we may not meet again for many years, I'd like to read this poem to you, to have you know I've loved you. Please, no, I couldn't stand it. All right, I'll leave the book here, with the place marked, in case you want to read it later. It's the poem beginning, How do I love thee? Let me count the ways. I love thee to the depth and breadth and height my soul can reach, when feeling out of sight for the ends of being and ideal grace. Billy put a small bottle on top of the book. I am also leaving you these pills. If you take one a month, you will never have children. And still, you'll be a nothing head. And he left. And they all left, but Nancy. When Nancy raised her eyes at last to the book and bottle, she saw that there was a label on the bottle. What the label said was this: Welcome to the Monkey House.
Long Walk to Forever, read by Tony Roberts.
They had grown up next door to each other, on the fringe of a city, near fields and woods and orchards, within sight of a lovely bell tower that belonged to a school for the blind. Now they were 20, had not seen each other for nearly a year. There had always been a playful, comfortable warmth between them, but never any talk of love. His name was Newt. Her name was Catherine. In the early afternoon, Newt knocked on Catherine's front door. Catherine came to the door. She was carrying a fat, glossy magazine she'd been reading. The magazine was devoted entirely to brides. Newt, she said. She was surprised to see him. Could you come for a walk? He said. He was a shy person, even with Catherine. He covered his shyness by speaking absently, as though what really concerned him were far away, as though he were a secret agent pausing briefly on a mission between beautiful, distant, and sinister points. This manner of speaking had always been Newt's style, even in matters that concerned him desperately. "A walk?" said Catherine. "One foot in front of the other," said Newt. "Through leaves, over bridges." "I had no idea you were in town," she said. "Just this minute got in," he said. "Still in the army, I see," she said. 7 more months to go," he said. He was a private first class in the artillery. His uniform was rumpled. His shoes were dusty. He needed a shave. He held out his hand for the magazine. "Let's see the pretty book," he said. She gave it to him. "I'm getting married, Newt," she said. "I know," he said. "Let's go for a walk." "I'm awfully busy, Newt," she said. "The wedding is only a week away." "If we go for a walk," he said, "it will make you rosy. It will make you a rosy bride." He turned the pages of the magazine. "A rosy bride like her. Like her. Like her," he said, showing her rosy brides. Catherine turned rosy, thinking about rosy brides. "That will be my present to Henry Stuart Chasins," said Newt. "By taking you for a walk, I'll be giving him a rosy bride." "You know his name?" said Catherine. "Mother wrote," he said. "From Pittsburgh?" "Yes," she said. "You'd like him." "Maybe," he said. Can you come to the wedding, Newt?" she said. "That I doubt," he said. "Your furlough isn't for long enough," she said. "Furlough?" said Newt. He was studying a 2-page ad for flat silver. "I'm not on furlough," he said. "Oh?" she said. "I'm what they call AWOL," said Newt. "Oh, Newt, you're not," she said. "Sure I am," he said, still looking at the magazine. "Why, Newt?" she said. "I had to find out what your silver pattern is," he said. He read names of silver patterns from the magazine. "Albemarle? Heather?" he said. "Legend? Rambler Rose?" He looked up, smiled. "I plan to give you and your husband a spoon," he said. "Newt, Newt, tell me, really," she said. "I want to go for a walk," he said. She wrung her hands in sisterly anguish. "Oh, Newt, you're fooling me about being AWOL," she said. Newt imitated a police siren softly, raised his eyebrows. "Where? Where from?" she said. "Fort Bragg," he said. "North Carolina?" she said. "That's right," he said. "Near Fayetteville, where Scarlett O'Hara went to school." "How did you get here, Newt?" she said. He raised his thumb, jerked it in a hitchhike gesture. 2 days," he said. "Does your mother know?" she said. "I didn't come to see my mother," he told her. "Who did you come to see?" she said. "You," he said. "Why me?" she said. "Because I love you," he said. "Now can we take a walk?" he said. "One foot in front of the other, through leaves, over bridges." They were taking the walk now. We're in a woods with a brown leaf floor. Catherine was angry and rattled, close to tears. "Newt," she said, "this is absolutely crazy." "How so?" said Newt. "What a crazy time to tell me you love me," she said. "You never talked that way before." She stopped walking. "Let's keep walking," he said. "No," she said. "So far, no farther. I shouldn't have come out with you at all," she said. "You did," he said. "To get you out of the house," she said. "If somebody walked in and heard you talking to me that way, a week before the wedding, what would they think?" he said. "They'd think you were crazy," she said. "Why?" he said. Catherine took a deep breath, made a speech. "Let me say that I'm deeply honored by this crazy thing you've done," she said. "I can't believe you're really AWOL, but maybe you are. I can't believe you really love me, but maybe you do." "But I do," said Newt. "Well, I'm deeply honored," said Catherine. "And I'm very fond of you as a friend, Newt. Extremely fond, but it's just too late." She took a step away from him. "You've never even kissed me," she said, and she protected herself with her hands. "I don't mean you should do it now. I just mean this is all so unexpected. I haven't got the remotest idea of how to respond." "Just walk some more," he said,
Have a nice time.
They started walking again.
How did you expect me to react? She said. How would I know what to expect? He said. I've never done anything like this before. Did you think I would throw myself into your arms? She said. Maybe, he said. I'm sorry to disappoint you, she said. I'm not disappointed, he said. I just wasn't counting on it. This is very nice, just walking. Catherine stopped again. You know what happens next? She said. Nope, he said. We shake hands, she said. We shake hands and part friends, she said. That's what happens next. Newt nodded. All right, he said. Remember me from time to time. Remember how much I loved you. Involuntarily, Catherine burst into tears. She turned her back to Newt, looked into the infinite colonnade of the woods. What does that mean? Said Newt. Rage, said Catherine. She clenched her hands. You have no right. I had to find out, he said. If I'd loved you, she said, I would have let you know before now. You would? He said. Yes, she said. She faced him, looked up at him, her face quite red. You would have known, she said. How? He said. You would have seen it, she said. Women aren't very clever at hiding it. Newt looked closely at Catherine's face now. To her consternation, she realized that what she had said was true, that a woman couldn't hide love. Newt was seeing love now, and he did what he had to do. He kissed her. You're hell to get along with, she said when Newt let her go. I am, said Newt. You shouldn't have done that, she said. You didn't like it? He said. What did you expect? She said. Wild, abandoned passion? I keep telling you, he said. I never know what's going to happen next. We say goodbye, she said. He frowned slightly. All right, he said. She made another speech. I'm not sorry we kissed, she said. That was sweet. We should have kissed. We've been so close. I'll always remember you, Newt. And good luck. You too, he said. Thank you, Newt, she said. 30 days, he said. What? She said. 30 days in the stockade, he said. That's what one kiss will cost me. I'm sorry, she said, but I didn't ask you to go AWOL. I know, he said. You certainly don't deserve any hero's reward for doing something as foolish as that, she said. Must be nice to be a hero, said Newt. Is Henry Stuart Chasen's a hero? He might be, if he got the chance, said Catherine. She noted uneasily that they had begun to walk again. The farewell had been forgotten. You really love him? He said. Certainly I love him, she said hotly. I wouldn't marry him if I didn't love him. What's good about him? Said Newt. Honestly, she cried, stopping again. Do you have any idea how offensive you're being? Many, many, many things are good about Henry. Yes, she said. And many, many, many things are probably bad, too. But that isn't any of your business. I love Henry, and I don't have to argue his merits with you. Sorry, said Newt. Honestly, said Catherine. Newt kissed her again. He kissed her again because she wanted him to. They were now in a large orchard. How did we get so far from home, Newt? Said Catherine. One foot in front of the other, through leaves, over bridges, said Newt. They add up. The steps, she said. Bells rang in the tower of the School for the Blind nearby. School for the Blind, said Newt. School for the Blind, said Catherine. She shook her head in drowsy wonder. I've got to go back now, she said. Say goodbye, said Newt. Every time I do, said Catherine, I seem to get kissed. Newt sat down on the close-cropped grass under an apple tree. "Sit down," he said. "No," she said. "I won't touch you," he said. "I don't believe you," she said. She sat down under another tree, 20 feet away from him. She closed her eyes. "Dream of Henry Stewart Chasins," he said. "What?" she said. "Dream of your wonderful husband-to-be," he said. "All right, I will," she said. She closed her eyes tighter, caught glimpses of her husband-to-be. Newt yawned. The bees were humming in the trees, and Catherine almost fell asleep. When she opened her eyes, she saw that Newt really was asleep. He began to snore softly. Catherine let Newt sleep for an hour, and while he slept, she adored him with all her heart. The shadows of the apple trees grew to the east. The bells in the tower of the school for the blind rang again.
"Chick-a-dee-dee-dee," went a chickadee.
Somewhere far away, an automobile starter nagged and failed, fell still. Catherine came out from under her tree, knelt by Newt. "Newt," she said.
"Mm-hmm,"
he said. He opened his eyes. "Late," she said. "Hello, Catherine," he said. "Hello, Newt," she said. "I love you," he said. "I know," she said. "Too late," he said. "Too late," she said. He stood, stretched groaningly. "A very nice walk," he said.
"I thought so," she said.
"Part company here?" he said.
"Where will you go?"
she said. "Hitch into town, turn myself in," he said.
"Good luck,"
she said.
"You too,"
he said.
"Marry me, Catherine."
"No," she said. He smiled, stared at her hard for a moment, then walked away quickly. Catherine watched him grow smaller in the long perspective of shadows and trees, knew that if he stopped and turned now, if he called to her, she would run to him. She would have no choice. Newt did stop. He did turn. He did call. "Catherine," he called. She ran to him, put her arms around him, could not speak.
The Foster Portfolio, read by Bill Irwin. I'm a salesman of good advice for rich people. I'm a contact man for an investment counseling firm. It's a living, but not a whale of a one, or at least not now when I'm just starting out. To qualify for the job, I had to buy a Homburg, a navy blue overcoat, a double-breasted banker's gray suit, black shoes, a regimental striped tie, half a dozen white shirts, half a dozen pairs of black socks, and gray gloves. When I call on a client, I come by cab, and I am sleek and clean and four square. I carry myself as though I've made a quiet killing on the stock market and have come to call more as a public service than anything else. When I arrive in clean wool, with crackling certificates and confidential stock analyses in crisp manila folders, the reaction, ideally and usually, is the same accorded a minister or physician. I'm in charge, and everything is going to be just fine. I deal mostly with old ladies, the meek who by dint of cast-iron constitutions have inherited sizable portions of the earth. I thumb through the clients' lists of securities and relay our experts' suggestions for ways of making their portfolios, or bonanzas, or piles, thrive and increase. I can speak of tens of thousands of dollars without a catch in my throat, and look at a list of securities worth more than $100,000 with no more fuss than a judicious, Since I don't have a portfolio, my job is a little like being a hungry delivery boy for a candy store. But I never really felt that way about it until Herbert Foster asked me to have a look at his finances. He called one evening to say a friend had recommended me, and could I come out to talk business? I washed, shaved, dusted my shoes, put on my uniform, and made my grave arrival by cab. People in my business, and maybe people in general, have an unsavory habit of sizing up a man's house, car, and suit, and estimating his annual income. Herbert Foster was a $6,000 a year, or I'd never seen it. Understand, I have nothing against people in moderate circumstances, other than the crucial fact that I can't make any money off them. It made me a little sore that Foster would take my time, when the most he had to play around with, I guessed, was no more than a few $100s. Say it was $1,000. My take would be $1 or $2 at best. Anyway, there I was in the Foster's jerry-built post-war colonial with expansion attic. They had taken up a local furniture store on its offer of 3 rooms of furniture, including ashtrays, a humidor, and pictures for the wall, all at $199.99. Hell, I was there, and I figured I might as well go through with having a look at his pathetic problem. "Nice place you have here, Mr. Foster," I said. "And this is your charming wife?" A skinny, shrewish-looking woman smiled up at me vacuously. She wore a faded house coat, figured with a fox-hunting scene. The print was at war with the slipcover of the chair, and I had to squint to separate her features from the clash about her. "A pleasure, Mrs. Foster," I said. She was surrounded by underwear and socks to be mended, and Herbert said her name was Alma, which seemed entirely possible. "And this is the young master," I said. "Bright little chap. Believe he favors his father." The 2-year-old wiped his grubby hands on my trousers, snuffled, and padded off toward the piano. He stationed himself at the upper end of the keyboard and hammered on the highest note for 1 minute, then 2, then 3. "Musical, like his father," Alma said.